This is Ozarks at Large for Friday, November 26, 2010. I'm Kyle Kellums. For this day after Thanksgiving, we're offering another book fair edition of Ozarks at Large. Occasionally, those of us who work on the program have an opportunity to talk to writers and authors from around the country. We'll hear some of those conversations today, the first time these book discussions have been on our daily show. We'll return to our regular format for Ozarks at Large on Monday. Later on this edition, we'll hear from writers examining bicycling and studying surfing, but we'll begin with a book about a snail. Elizabeth Tova Bailey was confined to her bed with a chronic disease when a friend brought her a plant to help brighten the room. The next day, Elizabeth began observing a single snail that unwittingly immigrated into the room inside the potted plant. Elizabeth's fascination with the small animal helped her deal with her condition and eventually led to the book The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. The remarkable book mixes science, philosophy, and memoir.
Well, the book is about is how a snail kind of got me through a very difficult year, and I had a very sudden viral illness that has resulted in a post-viral chronic situation, and I have years periodically that are particularly extreme in which I'm bedridden. And a friend brought me a pot of violets that she had dug up outside, and on a walk she had found a snail, and she happened to put the snail into the violet pot, and I began to watch the snail.
Now, to the uninitiated, you know, watching a snail, people will say, and then after 45 seconds, what'd you do then? But what you write about in such great detail is that it was an amazing creature to watch.
It was. I initially was kind of annoyed because I didn't know what to do with it, and I couldn't get out of bed, and my friend drove home, and there I was with a snail, and I kind of forgot about it, and then a few hours later, I noticed it had come out of its shell, and I just watched it because when you're lying in bed and you're too sick to read or watch TV and something's moving, you tend to just watch it. And it took a few days and I thought the next day I might just have wandered off and disappeared. I'd never see it. But the next day it had gone back to sleep in the violet pot for the day because they're nocturnal. And then in that second evening it came out of its shell and went exploring again. And as the days passed, it had this pattern to its life of where it slept and where it would go to explore, and I became quite curious and fascinated by it. And as time went on, it really became sort of a companion that was there day and night. And I got very intrigued. It, you know, had habits just like I did, and you know, woke up and went to bed like I did and liked good food and had little small snail-sized adventures.
and had its living space with it all the time.
That's right. One of the cool things about being a snail is you've got your camping equipment on your back, so you really can take off and go anywhere. But what was so intriguing was that in this particular case, in the beginning of the book anyway, it kept returning to the flower pot to sleep at night because that was the most natural habitat. If it had been out in the wild, it would have slept quite possibly in different places at different points during the day. But because it was in a very foreign terrain and there wasn't much that was natural, it kept going back to the flower pot, which is called homing when it goes back to the same place to sleep.
When one of my favorite little passages in the book, The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating, is when you start to consider the snail's shell and its shape, and then you remember that you had been at the Guggenheim, which, you know, kind of has a similar feel to it, and so you imagined the Guggenheim as your home with your head sticking out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I love that image.
I'm good. Yes, what happened, the year that the snail lived at my side, you know, most of my connection to it was companionship, kind of an emotional bond. I could feed it, and there was very little else I could do to help anybody else in the world. Mm-hmm. I could help this small creature. And it wasn't until I was writing the book that I learned so much about snails and how fascinating they are. And as I read the malacology literature, which is the science of mollusks and gastropods, the snail is a gastropod, reading about them in incredible detail, and how, and that information was so fascinating, and it got me thinking a lot about the differences and similarities between a snail and a human, and I had a lot of fun with that as a writer, as I worked on the book, just doing those comparisons. And you know, it's pretty amazing, this tiny little creature. Well, it has a lung just like we do because it's a land-dwelling animal, so in that way there's a similarity. On the other hand, their noses are really tentacles that have smell sensory cells on the tentacles, and they can move those around, whereas our nose is very firmly attached and can't wiggle very much at all. So these similarities and differences, as I was working on the book, just fascinated me and were really fun to explore.
Yeah, I mean, that, you know, this book is memoir of the year and of your relationship with the snail and what you kind of learned about yourself. But then there is also much information, much fascinating information about snails. Did you always know when you started to write The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating that it would have that sort of dichotomy, that balance?
I had no idea. I had my observations when I began the project, but I didn't know how I'd expand it into a book. I did know that I didn't really, as a writer, I've never wanted to write about myself, and I never wanted to write about illness at all. But I was just very fond of the snail, the fact that it got me through a year, and so the book was sort of a biographical thank you to the snail. And it was only as I started trying to figure out how to create a book and started, you know, I went to the malacology literature, the snail literature, to read about them, and just kind of fell in love with that, and it pulled me right into it, and that's kind of how the book expanded. And that allowed me to bring a little bit of the illness in here and there as well, but it really is, you know, 80% about the snail.
Some things that I guess I really didn't know about snails, but when you think about it, I'm not that surprised. Snails are pretty strong creatures.
Incredibly strong. They can pull many, many, many times their own weight. I think this is what I learned many things writing the book. One of them was that if you just take any creature and you really learn about everything about it, you know, does it have teeth? What kind of teeth? How strong is it? What can it do that a human can't do? You find yourself in awe. So this creature that's tiny and slow and you would think would be dull actually is very amazing. It's got the strength of Hercules. Snails have very romantic lives and fascinating courtship. They have methods for getting through rough times that as humans I think we can envy. They can go dormant, either hibernating in the winter or in the summer. They can estivate, another form of dormancy. So, and then, of course, they have the shell and can go on a camping trip at any moment with nothing but what's on their back. So I think it's kind of neat to learn enough about another species that you sort of find yourself in awe, even if it's small and slow. It still has an amazing life.
Yeah, and I suppose it's easier, and maybe it's because we're mammals, but it's much easier to be in fascination with, a grizzly bear or a blue whale or a dolphin. Mm. But when you really stop and consider a snail that is very tiny and, you know, I guess seemingly insignificant to many people, when you stop and you consider all these things that go on in its life, it can really make you think about what's going on in yours. Or is that trite?
I think that's very true. I think we're a very, humans are a very human-centric society. And if we do look outside of our own species, we tend to look at the mammals, you know, the larger family animal group that we belong to. And so this was, I think, so what was so fascinating was here I am looking at a creature that isn't a mammal. It's in the mollusk family. And, you know, who would think that a mollusk could be a companion? and in fact, one of the malacologists who consulted with me, Tim Pierce at the Carnegie Natural History Museum was initially so interested in my observations that he got quite interested in setting up experiments for people with chronic illnesses who happened to be bedridden to monitor snail experiments.
When did you know that you were done with the book?
That's a very good question, because actually I think I do have an Aristotle quote in the book. My memory is not the best part of me. I write very visually and with sound. But that's a very, very interesting question. I think I knew I was done when I was totally saturated, because I kept finding more information. For instance, I had turned in my manuscript and I came across some Charles Darwin letters that I didn't know about and had to rewrite a chapter, and I kept finding more additional pieces I wanted to sneak into the pages, but there was a point at which one more snail piece of information, and I just knew I couldn't deal with it. So I would say it was saturation, but it was a four-year project.
Right.
So I think it just, you know, the structure was very challenging organizationally as a writer to come up with a structure for this book. There's so many interesting aspects of an animal, and you have to kind of find a way to weave them together in a way that makes sense, and that was a real challenge.
But you did it beautifully.
Thank you.
Were there any conversations, I'm not too keen on how publishing works, but when anyone said, really? This book is going to have the word snail in the title, it's going to have snail on the cover, and in this ever more competitive world of getting people's attention? Did anyone ever kind of raise an eyebrow about this?
Well, I can say that whenever I told people what I was, you know, I would tell, if you tell somebody you're a writer, they immediately want to know what you write. And I would say, I'm writing about an animal. And they would say, well, what animal? Immediately pretty interested, because people generally like other animals. And I would say, well, it's a snail, and they would look completely surprised and say, oh, you mean snails, plural? And I would say, no, it's a book actually about one particular snail, and they would look completely astonished and not know what to say next. They were fascinated but sort of speechless. And the funny thing is that after somebody reads the book, they will then say, I can't believe I read a whole book about a snail. And they're equally surprised even afterward. I think that, yes, it was a very unusual project to turn into a book, and even I did not know it would become as large a book as it's a very small book, but even so, I didn't think it would have the length that it does have. But it seems to be somehow quite universal in terms of the readership it's gathering, I think, because all of us want some connection to the natural world, and we're all curious about other animals. And interspecies relationships particularly fascinate us. I think within our own species, you can only learn so much about the world, and an interspecies relationship pulls you into a whole different world. It shows you a window into another way to live on Earth, and that's what really fascinated me and kept me working on the book.
The name of the book is The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. Elizabeth Tova Bailey, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Elizabeth Tova Bailey is the author of The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating. This is a book fair edition of Ozarks at Large. Coming up, a blogger named Bike Snob writes about bicycling. That's ahead on Ozarks at Large. The ability to maneuver a bicycle for pleasure and for transportation to work is becoming safer and easier in several area cities. A new swath of the Frisco Trail is connecting the path across Dixon and Maple Streets in Fayetteville, connecting Martin Luther King Boulevard all the way to the Botanical Gardens and beyond in Springdale. Likewise, Rogers and Bentonville are planning and creating new stretches to take cyclists along major corridors. If you get on a bicycle for fun, for business, or for something else, you should consider the new book, Bike Snob, Systematically and Mercilessly Realigning the World of Cycling by the blogger, cyclist, and now author Bike Snob NYC, also known as Eben Weiss. The book offers a thorough and often hilarious guide to bicycles and bicycling. Eben, welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You write under the pseudonym that includes snob in the title, but your book seems to be more anti-snobbery than anything else. Certainly, there seems to be a big umbrella for all kinds of cyclists.
Yeah, absolutely. I did not want to be snobby in the book in the literal sense. I kind of try to, in the blog and in the book, I kind of try to turn the snob thing on its ear a little bit. I am snobby when it comes to being a little judgmental when people do silly stuff, but in terms of something being rarefied or inaccessible, I don't like that. I'm not a fan of that. I like stuff to be accessible.
Well, you start at the beginning from the penny farthing, the classic old bicycle with the unbelievably large front wheel, to really what was the first national fascination with bicycles. There was even a regular New York Times feature, Gossip of the Cyclers.
Yeah, that's right. It was the penny farthing, I mean, even before they figured out how to get the wheels of the bike the same size and not have you sitting way up in the air like that, I mean, even the penny farthing was hugely popular. That's what got people hooked on cycling, and it's just something we seem naturally to enjoy doing. It's been hugely popular since the beginning.
Most of the book does pay attention to contemporary cycling, and you address rules of the road, the ones that should be followed, and you think there are some that can be altered or adapted, don't you?
I do. First of all, I should say that I am an advocate of safe cycling and all of that stuff, and I know there's a lot of conflicts on the roads among different road users, whether they're drivers and cyclists, and some people tend to think cyclists don't follow the rules of the road. I believe in following the rules of the road. However, I do think just because of the way most of our cities and towns are designed, they're not really designed with cyclists in mind. So I think with experience, until the infrastructure kind of catches up with the way modern people are using and sharing the roads, I do think with experience and wisdom, you can here and there when there's a traffic rule or law or signal that really doesn't work for you as a cyclist, you can kind of circumvent it.
If you're at the four-way stop and it's apparently, or a red light and it's apparent there's no traffic coming, rolling on is all right.
I think it is uncertain. If it's totally safe and if you're not cutting anybody off or bothering a pedestrian or anything. And a lot of that depends on where you are, though. I mean, for example, where I live, where there's a lot of car traffic, there are times when stopping at an intersection along with cars, and if you wait for the light to change, I mean, sometimes the cars behind you will be bearing down on you, and sometimes you kind of need that head start at the red light. I think the answer down the line is you have signals that are timed differently for different users.
You write that you are not bothered by the honking or sometimes blaring horn of a car when you're on a road.
That's right. Well, I am bothered in the sense that anybody kind of beeping at you can be irritating, but I'm not bothered in the way that I'm going to rush to get out of their way.
Right.
Because really the only person who has a right to make a sound and expect me to jump out of their way if I'm doing everything I should be is an ambulance or a fire. Otherwise, if I'm moving too slow for you, you can go around me. It's not really going to take any time out of your day.
You have this great exchange that might be somewhat created, but this perhaps somewhat imaginary exchange or compiled exchange you've had with people who drive cars and expect that you should get over for them.
Yeah. There is a certain mentality some people have. And I should say that most, not all cyclists, but many cyclists drive cars too. But I think what happens when you have some people who drive cars and don't ever use any other form of transportation seem to think that anything on the road that's not a car is an imposition. And it's just such a infuriating thing to hear if somebody's beeping at you to get out of your way and you say, what's your problem? What's going on? They say, well, you're on a bike. You should get out of my way, which is just not the case.
My favorite section is sort of of a field guide to cyclists and all the different types there are and who gets along with whom. And there's a lot of tongue-in-cheek here, but it does show that not everyone who gets on a bicycle does it for the same reason, but everyone who does get on a bicycle, more or less, is a cyclist.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the number one thing to remember is that There are so many different ways to enjoy riding your bike, and you can do it in a totally utilitarian and practical way. You can do it purely for recreation. You can be a serious racer. You can just get out and have fun. It really doesn't matter. I do think the different types of cyclists and the way they get into it, though, are kind of fascinating and funny. Part of the reason I did that in the book was kind of to kind of pigeonhole and make fun of all the different types of cyclists. I think it's important to do that because it makes the whole thing seem less intimidating. I think it's important to remember, as cyclists, we're all pretty funny. Anybody who gets way into something, can be funny. So I don't think there's anything wrong with laughing at that. And I certainly recognize myself in a lot of those types.
You certainly don't over-romanticize. One thing you write is, bicycles do not have a soul.
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that. I think a lot of people, it's like anything. You can get into cycling just like you can get into all kinds of things, whether it's cars, food, boats,
guitars,
whatever. Yeah, guitars, any kind of thing. You can get way, way, way into the bicycle itself. And, a bicycle's a really cool machine, but you reach a point where you become obsessed with it, and it only ends in tears, especially because a bicycle can get damaged or stolen. And then where are you? You should be enjoying riding the thing. You should keep a little perspective, I think. So I warn about that in a humorous way in the book. I think anyone who rides a bike has broken one or stolen one, or rather had one stolen.
Had one stolen, right.
Yeah, yeah. Hopefully not stolen one.
You address a hurdle that many people, myself included, use for saying why we don't ride our bikes more often to work or around a town, and that's because we don't feel safe.
I hear that from a lot of people, and there are reasons, certainly valid reasons, to be wary out on the road. There's dangers and all of that stuff. I'm certainly not saying it's a risk-free endeavor, but at the same time, driving your car isn't risk-free at all. And in fact, you're probably more likely to get injured or killed in your car than on your bike. A lot of this stuff, I think, is perception, the idea that cycling is hugely dangerous. And it's reinforced by people. People who don't ride bikes see people on bikes, and they think, wow, they're crazy. They're out there with the cars, And so it's this, it becomes an implicit thing in our culture, for lack of a better word, that riding a bike is something crazy people do. And it's just not true. If you ride your bike smart and get a little experience under your belt, it's really, there's no reason not to do it. And it gets safer all the time because more people are doing it and more cities are improving things and everybody's learning. So,
and there is a section in this book that is very basic, down to earth, how to fix a flat, how to keep care of your saddle and your chain, things that the first time cyclist or someone who's more experienced needs to know.
Yeah. I mean, my purpose in putting that stuff in there was less as a manual and more just to remind people, or if you didn't know in the first place, tell people that the bicycle is just a really simple machine. Pretty much anybody can do the basic maintenance they need to do. And just like making fun of the different types of cyclists is a way to say to people, don't get hung up on worrying how you look. Don't get hung up on thinking you need this or that to ride a bike. Just ride it. It's the same thing with that mechanical section you're talking about. I think I basically say, you have to keep the chain lubed. You should know how to fix a flat tire, just like you should know how to change a tire on your car. Here's a couple of tips for getting yourself comfortable on the bike, and that's it. It's really a simple thing, and cycling is one of those things where just by riding every day, you just learn. It teaches, the bike will teach you pretty much everything you need to know.
Now, when you're deciding whether or not to ride, you look to Hollywood as your guide. And people, when they pick up this book, might not know that D.W. Griffith, Al Jolson, and Alfred Hitchcock will be mentioned. Explain the movie system.
Yeah, I kind of calibrated the temperatures, the ambient temperatures with with a timeline of Hollywood films, which is kind of hard to explain, I guess, in words, but it's pretty obvious if you look in the book. Basically, the more recent the movie, the hotter it gets is how it works.
When did you decide that after being with the blog that this could be a book that could go on a shelf?
It was something, as a writer, you always have a book. You always have books in mind, and that you'd always like to write a book. But even when the blog started getting popular, I didn't necessarily think of a book, because I didn't want the book just to be what the blog was. And I don't think the blog works as a book in that, you can't be super topical. And my blog is very self-referential and all of that stuff. I didn't want to do just kind of like a book of pictures of silly bikes. And then maybe I had been doing it a year or something like that. It's hard to remember, but I was actually riding home from work one evening, and I was just thinking about why I write my blog and why I ride my bike, and the reason just being that that underneath it all, cycling is something that's made me very happy and has taught me a lot of things. It's taught me about myself, and it's taught me about the world, and I wanted to write a book that, in a funny way, expressed that and made the people who experience it the same way I do kind of reaffirm that for them, and also something that somebody who is kind of interested in the world of cycling from outside could read and enjoy and be encouraged by. So that was it. It kind of hit me on the way home from work that's what I needed to do. It needed to be more than just silly, but the book is silly. Don't get me wrong. It's important to be silly.
It is silly, but it is, I think, especially for people who might fall into my category as people who might be on a bicycle more than once a week, but not every day, and certainly can have a few weeks pass by where it doesn't come out of the garage.
Mm-hmm.
I think it fits nicely for us.
Oh, well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I wanted it to really cover all of that. I mean, there's people who feel like they're going through withdrawal if they don't ride their bike every day, and there's people who train for races every day, and they, even though they don't get paid to do it and have jobs, and then there's people who just want to ride a bike when they feel like it, or they just want to ride to the store. They don't want to put on special clothes. They don't want special anything, and I'm speaking to all those people because we still all share that in common, that we enjoy to ride.
And learn how to lock up your bike.
Yeah, definitely. That's a common sense thing that not a lot of people are aware of, especially new riders. I mean, you hear the laments all the time, especially in a big city where I live, just the thefts. And going back to what you said about not getting too wrapped up in the bike itself, you just hear over and over people getting into riding, and they get this expensive bike at the source, all these fancy parts, and spend a bunch of money, and then you go lock it up with a flimsy lock, or you don't pass the chain through the frame properly, and it's gone. That's it. Thousands of dollars down the drain. So locking your bike is one of the most important things to know how to do unless you're never going to let the bike out of your sight.
The name of the book is Bike Snob: Systematically and Mercilessly Realigning the World of Cycling by Bike Snob NYC, also known as Evan Weiss. Evan, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you very much. My pleasure.
Hello, this is Robert Ginsberg, your host for Shades of Jazz, every Friday night from 10 till midnight. On tonight's show, we'll hear music from Betty Carter and Peter Erskine, saxophonist Joe Lovano, and pianist Keith Jarrett. We'll also hear some great vibes from Milt Jackson. This and much more, Friday night at 10 p.m. at Shades of Jazz.
This is Ozarks at Large. Not too long ago, writer Peter Heller was in his mid-40s and had just finished an intense, dangerous assignment in Tibet. Actually, he had just finished the book about that assignment. He was at his Colorado home, wondering what was next. A phone call led to Peter spending a week with a longtime friend, learning to surf. Then the week was over. But Peter Heller's attraction with surfing turned into something of an obsession. Later, he and his girlfriend Kim took off for an extended trip as he learned more about surfing, and surfing let him learn more about himself. Peter Heller describes the adventures in his new book, Kook. Peter Heller, welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Glad to be here.
The title of the book refers to a new surfer, but kook is not a term like rookie or newbie. It carries with it a certain amount of disdain when it's used by experienced surfers, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's usually preceded by a bunch of epithets which you can't say on the radio, or maybe you can now with a court ruling. But first time I heard it, I went to spend a week with my buddy out in Huntington Beach. He'd been transferred there. He was having a rough year as a lawyer. Wondered if I wanted to learn to surf with him. We grabbed a couple of boards, trotted out into the waves at the Huntington Beach Pier, and that's sort of like, I mean, that'd be like a beginner golfer just, sauntering out onto Augusta and, you know, wanting to thwack some balls around. It's just not done. And the first surfer I encountered, you know, clearly an expert, nearly collided with me and came up spluttering and said, "You bleeping kook, get the bleep out of the water. I'm going to bleep you up." And, you know, it was in no uncertain terms. So that's the first time I heard it. And it kind of perfectly describes an entire attitude of, like, ignoring the finely tuned protocols of surf and rebel yelling when you do manage to stand up for a second and, paddling up to other surfers, talking like it's a cocktail party. That was me.
You know, as I was reading, and this is in the very first part of the book, as I was reading that, and you have paddled out and you see these other surfers and you start to go over there, as I was reading that, I was thinking to myself, and I've grown up in the middle of the country my whole life. I'm as far away from surfing as you can get. But I remember reading that thinking, well, he's not following protocol. I mean, did that not occur to you at that time?
It didn't, see, because I didn't know how waves broke. I mean, I was a river person my whole life, and ocean waves. I didn't really understand that a wave breaks at a peak. A good surfing wave you get this wall of water coming in, and if it's a good wave, it has sort of a level top. And then it starts to crumble and break at one point, and then rip that white sort of rips in a lateral line down the wall. And so a surfer basically is moving forward, but it's also moving laterally, moving sideways on the wave. So I thought, being 100 yards down the beach from these surfers, that I was out of their way. But come to find out, they were riding the wave right into my lap, and they didn't appreciate it.
The popular depiction of surfer culture is part Beach Boys, part Annette Funicello, and I guess a little bit of Spicoli, the Sean Penn character from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Mm-hmm. Are any of those depictions in any way legitimate?
I think it's interesting, this whole myth about surfing. I mean, I showed up, first of all, I just have to say that we got just swamped and hammered and probably stood up for, 2 seconds combined that first morning, and I was completely hooked. So there's something like totally intoxicating about just being in the waves, and if you do stand up for a second, you're done. I mean, you just want to surf again. And I had shown up with this sort of idea of the aloha spirit, this sort of relaxed, laid-back surfer dude, generous. And, it's not like that. It's not like those movies, surfers are competitive, they're territorial, and they're predatory. I mean, they're hunting their wave, and you don't want to get in their way. I think that the part that is like the movies is that the people that surf really, they really live for that. I mean, even the guys, the corporate guys who work at Boeing and, Lockheed Martin and stuff, they, they really lived for that hour in the morning before work.
You write that yoga is like maybe surfing, or dance is like surfing, that it connects us to our animal bodies. Without such things, we're just walking heads.
Might have been overstated. What I was getting at is that, I remember that passage. I compare, someone walking down a sort of a city street with their Starbucks and their head craned into their cell phone, wading across the street, kind of lifting their knees to climb the curb, not the most graceful species. I compared that to a single minnow just idling in the water, you know, and how she's at home as an element, and, you know, Mercury couldn't teach her anything about darting around. And I think in some ways the way we live today, you know, in front of our screens half the time, we do lose touch with our bodies. And I love the idea of trying at least to move with an intention of power and rhythm and grace. And if you see a good surfer, that's what you see. You see somebody who's almost not like a human anymore, like some sort of amphibious, you know, marine animal. And that's what I was getting at. But, of course, when you start surfing, you might as well forget about rhythm and grace.
you wrote that you were something of a commitment phobe, or at least that the work you most enjoyed, writing about something in Tibet or going on a ship to Antarctica to learn about deep sea whaling, these were things that kept you away from home. To me, it seems counterintuitive that, of all things, surfing would lead you back to commitment. I mean, again, I guess it goes to the popular perception of surfing kind of being this loner sort of activity.
Yeah, I mean, it's counterintuitive to me. It was such a surprise. I mean, I thought, well, I was dating this gal that I really, really liked a lot, and I thought, well, okay, all I want to do is surf now. Maybe I could do this. I had this idea. Could you drop everything, you know, in the middle of your life? I was 47. Pick up a surfboard and go from kook to riding a big, fast wave like you see in the movies in 6 months, you know. And I love those kind of challenges. I set those for myself because it's fun. You know, I like the drinking out of the fire hose, steep learning curve approach. And I thought, well, I could do that. And at the same time, I could invite Kim to come with me and, you know, really, you know, get to know her. And maybe, you know, that would work out. And I came to find out that, first of all, surfing is a lifelong path, and it's not something that you just, you know, you don't become a shredder in 6 months. What you do is become really humbled. And you do, if you pay attention, get some real communion with the sea, which was, you know, to me, very, very meaningful. And, you know, and I did, you know, actually get strong and learn to ride some waves. But this idea of bringing the girlfriend, I didn't know what was in store for me. What happened was, you know, the whole trip turned into rather a love story. And I learned about patience and acceptance. And a lot of that, you know, was drummed into me every day by the sea.
The name of the book is Kook. It's by Peter Heller. You can find out more about Kook and his other books at his website, peterheller.net. Peter Heller, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks a lot for having me.
This is Friday, Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums, and with me in the studio is Becca Baker Martin. She is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
Kyle, I've been up since 3:30.
Well, not today, because when people are hearing you and me talk, it's Friday.
But they've been up since 3:30.
Some of them have, yes.
Because this is
Black Friday. Do you participate in that? Do you go out and get early deals?
I have, yes. Yes, I have. They say the National Retail Federation says 138 million people were out today shopping.
It wasn't 138 million in one. It's not for me. We are taping this ahead of time because of the holiday.
Well, if you've been out, I hope that you've survived, and I assume you'll be out again the other 2 days of the weekend. So we have a little game that Kyle and I are going to play.
Fantastic.
It appeared in today's What's Up, and I'm going to give you some clues for the scavenger hunt. We'll have the answers on Sunday, or you can run out and get today's paper and see them. Don't answer.
You're talking to me?
Yes.
Okay.
Even if they answer, I can't hear them.
so if I know the answer, don't say it.
Don't say
okay.
it, because that'll ruin the scavenger
gotcha.
Hunt.
Gotcha. I gotcha.
So these are things that you can see while you're out shopping.
I see.
A 7-story statue with open arms.
Okay, I think I know what that is.
A bronze Popeye.
I think I know where that is.
2 concrete armchairs.
I know where that is.
Here's a quote. On the first floor is a spacious lobby, its ceiling reaching in the center to the third floor. Circled on the second floor with the balconies of the mezzanine lounge. Here are found wonderful arches and pillars so characteristic of the architecture of old Spain, with decorations of parallel lines of opposing colors, of the interweaving of Arabic inscriptions on wall decorations in gold and rich tints. What's the place that goes with?
I don't know.
Well, I'm going to tell you later.
I know.
A statue of a Confederate soldier that pays homage to James H. Berry.
Okay.
A 10-foot diameter bronze peace globe.
Okay.
The Ritter McDonald log cabin, which was built in the 1850s at Elm Springs.
Okay.
A 30-foot tall Mr. Peanut.
Oh, I know where that is.
And a penguin. Actually, two colorfully dressed penguins.
I know where those are.
Run out and get a paper. You can find out the answers and see the photographs. Or if you're terminally puzzled, hang on and come back Sunday and we'll give you the answers.
That's on weekend Ozarks at Large. It begins at 9 Sunday morning.
Also going on this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
On Saturday, the Arts Eureka Fall Art Show.
Yes.
From 9 to 7 at the end of the Ozarks Convention Center. Admission is $2. By the time you hear this, I will be in Eureka Springs judging. Because they give prizes.
I see.
So that'll be fun. There's a Saturday cinema at 10 a.m. at Rogers Public Library. They're showing Marmaduke.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Galileoscope workshop at Hobbs State Park.
Right. Which was very popular the first time they did it.
Starts at 3 o'clock. You pay $35, but you get to take home your Galileoscope. It's followed by a beginning astronomy class at 4:15. And tonight is the Christmas, or Saturday night, rather, is the Christmas Parade of the Ozarks at 6 o'clock in downtown Springdale. On Sunday, the Eureka Art Show continues, and the Sacred Harp Singers meet at 1:30 at the Shiloh Museum in Springdale. You can go learn about the hymn singing of
shape
the past.
Note singing.
Shape note singing.
Right.
Thank you.
And tomorrow afternoon, big game kickoff, LSU-Arkansas, 2:30 in Little Rock.
Right, what he said.
Okay. Becca, now this is going to be odd because I'm going to wish you a happy Thanksgiving because we're actually taping this before Thanksgiving, but it'll be heard after.
Well, happy Thanksgiving anyway. Or happy Black Friday. Good luck.
Pleasant weekend to you. Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
I'm Ira Glass. Every year near Thanksgiving, This American Life brings you our annual program about poultry.
You ready for a bird?
Chickens, ducks, turkeys.
That's the day we had before the night 3,000 turkeys died.
Real and fictional.
Chicken! He's everywhere!
This week, the tradition continues.
Why would you do that?
Ooh, Lord, I want to eat that chicken.
This American Life with Ira Glass, tomorrow morning at 6 and Sunday morning at 10 on KUAF 91.3 FM. Spey, Arkansas will host a holiday music celebration and silent auction Sunday afternoon from 2 until 5 at the Whole Earth Organic Lounge in Fayetteville. Performers Sunday afternoon include Emily Cates, Susan Shore and Michael Cochran, and Candy Lee. Food will also be available. Proceeds will go to support the end of homeless pets in Northwest Arkansas. For more information, SpeyArkansas.org. And Saturday, December 4th, the Fort Smith Museum of History will have an open house from 2 until 4 that afternoon. You can enjoy cookies, hot chocolate, and free admission before or after the Fort Smith Christmas Parade. For more information about the events on Saturday, December 4th at the Fort Smith Museum of History, 783-7841. And it is time for the KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway. Thanks to our KUAF underwriters, it's our chance to give back to you. You could win a gift from War Eagle Mill and Restaurant, I Am Spa, the University of Arkansas Bookstore, or Mud Puppy Pottery Studios in Fort Smith. Details and registration available on the web at KUAF.com. The drawing will be held Thursday, December 16th, during Classical Music with P.J. Hrabowski. Please, just one entry per person. Thanks and good luck. Ozarks at Large is supported by Penguin Ed's Barbecue, offering smoked turkey, ham, and salmon for the holidays, and booking reservations for their banquet room and catering. Homemade cookies and cakes are available. With three locations in Fayetteville, PenguinEds.com for more information. Support is also provided by Entertainment Fort Smith, a monthly magazine with a comprehensive calendar of events covering performances, dining, home design, lifestyles, and profiles of exceptional people. Available at over 200 locations, on the web at efortsmith.com. And local support for Ozarks at Large also comes from RLT, presenting a Tuna Christmas and encouraging Tuna for Tuna at the Victory Theater in Rogers. Patrons of the comic play A Tuna Christmas are asked to purchase or donate cans of tuna to help fill the Northwest Arkansas Food Bank. 631-8988 or rogerslittletheater.org for showtimes, tickets, or more information. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, and Green Forest, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years. Remember, you can listen online at KUAF.com. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend. Don't forget, you can hear Weekend Ozarks at Large Sunday morning at 9 on KUAF.